we're meeting very close to the end of the cycle of time. And as we approach the end, time accelerates. I'm sure all of you have noticed that. The number of events per day of extraordinary end time significance, largely events of breakdown, social breakdown, breakdown of machines, infrastructure, social systems, breakdown of order of every kind, and the breakdown and the crack-up are correlative, because those who cannot tolerate the breakdowns that are happening at every fractal level tend to begin to lose their own internal psychological balance, especially if they don't have an accurate context for understanding the logic of events and the benign destiny of all that is unfolding for those who are aware and attuned to the vibrational frequency of what is emerging as well and blossoming as well as what is breaking down. Because it's only the unreal, the technological, and the egocentric that breaks down. But that which is based in the real is organic and is eternal and invulnerable to the vicissitudes of time and space, and is able to endure without being touched by those events, because they are recognized as a dream field. And the awakened dreamer is able to sail through the, let's say, the white water of Chronos time as it approaches its final fate of emptying out into the ocean of consciousness that is no longer within the phenomenal plane or the space-time continuum, but returns to its original unmanifest nature as pure light, from which all of the collapsed quantum and qualium wave functions have decollapsed, and the light now returns to its formless essence. And in that transformation of energies from manifest to unmanifest, the permutations of every possibility must unfold and emerge and also complete their karmic trajectory before the end of time, and thus they must emerge in very surprising and extreme forms. And so we have seen in recent days the rather blatant breakdown in the U.S. of the injustice system, or at least the justice system became an injustice system in the Trump trial, and that has created an incredible increase of tension within that social order that is breaking down as the result of the lack of trust in the and legitimacy of the governmental authorities. And as the legitimacy disappears for more and more beings than the system itself loses the necessary backing to be able to continue to function at any of its levels, not just simply within one department, but within all of the manifestations of that no longer trusted authority. And so we are seeing a breakdown of social order and of heightened civil unrest. At the same time that we're also witnessing the very blatant onset of further plans of those who are, let's say, middle management of the depopulation program and its next phase of unfoldment. And so we're seeing the beginnings of manifest food shortages and manifest breakdown of the order of life as was expected. So, for example, in Europe, they are announcing mandatory conscription now of young adults into the army, men and women, and preparing for a war with Russia. And of course, this is not what the social contract had offered previously. And so this is also creating shockwaves and resistances and great anxiety as the world approaches the precipice of a final war that is no longer being hidden, but being openly spoken about as the goal of the policy that is motivating all of the activities of the various Western governments, for sure. And in that, the excuses that people made of stupidity or of an unawareness of what these escalatory actions would lead to are no longer able to be upheld, and the very deliberate intention behind all of this is becoming manifest. And because it's moving so rapidly, it's extremely important that our own processes of conscious realization of the ultimate presence of the intelligence that underlies and is actually moving all of the pieces on the chessboard. And it's not the pieces that move themselves. They are moved by a power that transcends the activities, whether they are considered by any of the characters in the play as good or evil, and whether it's of East or West or of one power block or another, all of it is moving toward a particular ultimate climactic confrontation and explosion. And so it is of essential importance that satyogis be in that state of consciousness that is already and always transcendent of the drama, by realizing you are formless, luminous intelligence, and your own creative capacity to perceive the beauty within the horror of the collapse and destruction, and to perceive the will of God moving through these various mid-level conspiratorial activities that are themselves unaware of their own roots within a deeper consciousness than they are aware of, that is moving them beyond the illusion of their free will as alleged masters of the situation, who are actually literally to be the fall guys of the plot and to be instruments of that power that transcends the intentions of the actors. And so we are in that phase in which many people are awakening out of denial that they had been in before, in terms of seeing the precipice that is being approached in the world, but they do not see the larger context of return to the light, of the revelation of the presence of God, and the redemption that is inherent in this movement from incarnation to the excarnated state of the reunion with the single whole intelligence that had always been the absolute core of every being, but because of their misidentification with the mental operating system of the body, were not aware and attuned and liberated from the growing anxiety of the internal narrative of the chattering mind, and without the power to silence that mind and receive inspirations and downloads from the mind of God directly and become instruments of the transmission, both of the wisdom, the light, the joy, the love, the peace and serenity as the world approaches this final period in which there is no internal disturbance. And one has reached a point beyond acceptance and rejection, beyond all dualities. And this state is a very subtle one to achieve. And so one of the foci of the teaching tonight is to encourage you to be aware of the paradoxical non-duality of your character's heightened awareness of all of the impossibilities within the dream field, the glitches, the breakdowns and the crack-ups, and the lack of rapport, the lack of connection between beings, and the frustrations and anger and the other kinds of lower chakra actings out that are increasing among egos whose dregs of deeply repressed sanskaras have to come up in order to be witnessed in their totality and deliberately, consciously destroyed, annihilated, dissolved in the service of God, so that there is no longer any attachment to karma, to maya, to the core sanskara of the ego complex itself, so that one is free to graduate from this level of the world process and return to God consciousness without any tie to Kali Yuga that would require one to return to a state of ignorance, whether in this life or in some other. So yogis must be in that quality of God consciousness that is total freedom. And that is freedom from the dualistic logic of the ego complex itself, freedom from attachments and sanskaras of egoic modes of relating to the world, and a complete recognition of the unreality, or at least the fictional nature of the theodrama of the world, and are able to put the impress of the great playwright who is the mastermind of this production and become an instrument of that that supreme dramatist, who is able to rewrite your own character to become a transparent agency of that one supreme and absolute presence that is one of unifying compassion, love, and offer the principle of friendship to every being who feels abandoned, lonely, and unseen, unperceived in their real nature because they do not perceive themselves, their own nature. And so it's the gift of the vision of the self to the self within every being that is the bodhisattvic function of the satyogi. So I hope that is clear, and that in itself is what undoes any remaining karma that one's own character had, and frees the consciousness from the anavamala, from the identification with an individual body, because now one is living altruistically, altruistically, and not in the false self of the ego that is involved in grasping and power hunger and in the various pursuits of jouissance, rather than the blissful unification with the absolute self. It's this shift that now must be completed. So, given the fact that things are accelerating in the world, our process must become more and more intense until there is no interruption in our remembrance of that absolute egoless presence that underlies all of the conscious activity of mind and body, and allow that inner divine luminosity to govern the actions and liberate the consciousness from any thoughts that are still attached to the dualistic program of the ego. But it's also important not to confuse levels. So, as all the sages have said, we must go beyond every duality, including that of acceptance and rejection. And yet, it's impossible to do that as a character within the play. Within the play, decisions must be made. And certain paths are taken and others not taken. And for example, I remember Sri Ramana during his more elderly period was constantly harassed by his attendants who would want him to drink some very bitter medicine, and he would refuse it. They would beg him and, you know, stay and say, "You've got to drink this, Ramana, you know, you need this." And he's, no, I'm not interested. So he was rejecting. He wasn't beyond acceptance and rejection. He accepted the food that tasted good and, you know, he ate that quite willingly, but the medicine he wasn't interested in. So, however, if you understand the function of the character he was playing in the drama, that rejection was part of his renunciation of the drive to extend his life for as long as possible. He was not a health nut, you know. He didn't take vitamins and supplements and all kinds of things that most of us are addicted to and use to try to extend a lifespan, despite the fact that we know life's going to end pretty soon, regardless of what we might do on that level, because the whole time cycle is about to end. And our own value system has to be modified in such a way that we can let go of any attachment to that ongoing drive in order to be free to accept whatever is the fate that God has in store for us. So it doesn't mean choosing the lower death drive, but it means that one's activities should be governed by the will of that power which is beyond any concern with the fate of the body, whether life or death is on the immediate horizon. And that doesn't mean you won't make choices of what you want or don't want at any particular moment, but who you are who is making that choice should be someone who is already in that state of non-duality, so that there is no anxiety or fear or neediness that motivates one's activity, so those sanskaras can be eliminated. So I think that's basically the message that I wanted to give tonight regarding our sadhana, and to mention as well that I feel it important to increase the focus that we give in our teachings to that ultimate state of supreme freedom, so that we understand it in a symbolic way very clearly. There's no confusion about what freedom really is. And we don't confuse it with the ego's desire to have autonomy and agency at that level and wanting to do what it wants to do and violate whatever are the the rules of the dharmic order, for example, but a freedom from the ego's sanskaras that enables one to be in a flow state and the intelligence of the Tao to move one through life. So, I hope that's clear. And in order to increase that focus, I've decided that I would lead a book group. It's been a long time that I've done that. And so I've been trying to choose which book would be accurate, and there are several that I think we should read before the end, and that I think will all be of some value in the process of your own self-realization. And so the first book that I want to go over with you is a book of poetry by a great tantric Buddhist master from Tibet, who lived in the late 1700s, early 1800s, whose name was Lama Shabkar. And he wrote many books, but the book of his that I want to focus on, which is only some 20-some poems in it, and I hope we can go over at least many of them line by line. The title of the book is The Flight of the Garuda. Okay? The Flight of the Garuda. Now, I found two translations. One by, what's his name? Eric Pema Kunsang. And that's online. And another by Keith Dowman, The Flight of the Garuda. And each book contains a lot of different information and texts, but that one is present in both of these. And you could read either one, but the one I'm going to actually go over, I decided, is this one by Eric Pema Kunsang. Because I think it overall is more, let's say, true to the style of the original intention of the sage who wrote those poems, even though in translation you always lose a huge amount of the subtext, the many different associations the words have in the Tibetan language that cannot be carried over into English. And of course, the rhymes and rhythms, etc., are all lost. So they are actually prose poems in translation. But in any case, we'll try to begin this on Wednesday. And maybe you can get it. Both of them are, as I say, online and available to be downloaded. But I don't expect you to have necessarily read any by then. But we'll go over the first one or two of the poems then, and I think you'll see right away the power that they have, even in translated form. So, and I think it will clarify the difference between the Vedic understanding of Garuda as a symbol and the Buddhist application of that symbol in a slightly different discourse. So, the tantric Buddhists and the Shaivite tantric wisdom schools that were in parallel in a very close region of the world in which they were in contact with each other. There was a lot of interpenetration of wisdoms and of insights between the two. They were not so much in opposition as they were more like a left eye and a right eye, and both of them are worth seeing the world through. The particular signifiers, to recognize the oneness of the signified, regardless of whether they begin from a Buddhist or a Vedic or Shaivite ultimate paradigm, they lead to the same absolute. So that's it. I hope people are interested and excited to read the book together and to reflect deeply upon the meaning of these very short, pithy, and powerful expressions of non-duality. Okay? Okay.